You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures translated by Christian von Arnim, entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition that Satisfies the Human Being. This is Lecture 2, given in Dornach on the 18th of September, 1915. I spoke yesterday about a kind of ascending movement that is rooted in human nature. And basically, through the contemplation of this ascending movement, we have found again everything that we already know, namely, on the lowest level, the knowledge that is only applicable to the facts of the physical plane, the physical knowledge, which is called object knowledge in title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? So, physical knowledge is what I want to call it today. We then get to know the next higher level of knowledge, the so-called imaginative knowledge, but we considered it as unconscious imaginative knowledge. Conscious imaginative knowledge can, after all, only be present in a person who tries to attain it in the way described in the book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? The words physical knowledge, unconscious imaginative knowledge, conscious imaginative knowledge were written on the blackboard, see diagram 4, page 33, close bracket. But as a fact, the content of imaginative knowledge, that is, imaginations, is in every human being. So that actually the development of the human soul in this respect is nothing other than an extension of consciousness into an area that is always within the human soul. So we can say this imaginative knowledge is no different from the way it would be with objects that are in an initially dark room. For in the depths of the human soul, all the imaginations that first come into consideration for the human being are just as present as the objects of a dark room. And just as these are not increased by a single one when light is brought into the room, but just as all remain as they are, only that they are illuminated, so too, after the consciousness of imaginative knowledge has awakened, there is no content in the soul other than what was there before. It is only illuminated by the light of consciousness. So to a certain extent we experience nothing more through the ascent to the imaginative level of cognition than what has long been previously present in our soul as a sum of imaginations. If we look back once more at what became clear to us yesterday, we know that when our ideas, which we gain about the objects around us through our physical perceptions, sink down into the realm of possible memories, that is, are lowered into the unconscious, so that we find ourselves in the position of not knowing anything about them for some time, not having lost them, but being able to bring them up again from the soul, then we must say that we lower down into the unconscious that which we have in ordinary physical consciousness. The world of conceptions we obtain through physical knowledge of the outer world is therefore constantly absorbed by our spiritual part, by the supersensory. It continually slips into the supersensory realm. At every moment, it is the case that we obtain conceptions of the outer world through the physical perceptions, and these conceptions are handed over to our supersensory nature. It will not be difficult for you to reflect on this, after all that has been said over the years, because this is precisely the most superficial supersensory process that is conceivable, a process that is continually taking place. The transition of ordinary conceptions into conceptions we can remember. So it is natural to think, which is also true according to spiritual research, that everything that takes place when we perceive the outer world is a process of the physical plane. Even when we form conceptions based on the physical external world, this is still a process of the physical plane. But the moment we let the conceptions sink down into the unconscious, we are already at the entrance to the supersensory world. This is indeed a very important point, which must be taken into consideration by anyone who wants to attain an understanding of the occult world, not through all kinds of occultist twaddle, but through serious human effort of the soul. For there is already a quite essential fact hidden in the words which I have just spoken. When we, as human beings, face the things of the outer world and form conceptions, then this is a process of the physical plane. At the moment when the conception sinks down into the unconscious and is kept there until it is brought up again by a memory, a supersensory process, a real supersensory process, takes place. So that you can say to yourself, if we are to follow this process, which consists in the fact that a thought which is above, in the consciousness, sinks down into the subconscious, and is there below as an image, if we can, in other words, follow an idea as it is down in the unconscious, then we actually already begin to slip into the realm of the supersensory. For just think, when you carry out the ordinary process of recollection, the conception must first come up into the consciousness, and you then see it up in the consciousness, never down in the unconscious. You must distinguish ordinary recollection from following the conceptions down into the unconscious. You can compare what takes place in remembering with a swimmer who sinks below the water and whom you continue to see until they are completely submerged. Now you are down and you don't see them anymore. When they come back up, you'll see them again. Steiner draws. It is the same with human conceptions. You have them as long as they are on the physical plane. When they go down, you've forgotten them. If you remember them again, then they come up again like the swimmer. But this process that I'm talking about now, which already points to imaginative cognition, could be compared to you submerging yourself and thus being able to see the swimmer below in the water, so that they do not disappear from your sight when they submerge. But nothing less follows from this than that the line I drew earlier, the base, as it were, below which the imagination sinks into the unconscious, into possible memories, is the threshold of the spiritual world itself, the first threshold of the spiritual world. This follows with absolute necessity. It is the first threshold of the spiritual world. Just think how close the human being is to this threshold of the spiritual world. The words threshold of the spiritual world were written next to the diagram. And now take a process by which we can try to get down there properly, to submerge. The process would be that you endeavor to pursue conceptions down into the unconscious. This can really only be done by trying. It can happen by doing something like the following. You have formed a conception of the outside world. You try to artificially evoke the process of memory independently of the outside world. Think of how this is recommended in Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. How is it achieved? In which the quite ordinary rule of looking back on the day's events is given. When you look back on the day's experiences, you practice entering, as it were, into the ways which the imagination itself takes by being submerged and rising again. So the whole process of recollection is designed to pursue the conceptions that have sunk below the threshold of consciousness. It is further said there, in Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved?, that we do well to trace back the conceptions we have formed in reverse, that is, from the end to the beginning. And if you want to review the day, to follow the stream of events backward from evening to morning. As a result, we have to make a different effort than is made by way of ordinary recall. And this different effort leads us to grasp, below the threshold of consciousness, as it were, what we had as a conception of our experience. And in the course of trying, we come to feel, to experience inwardly, how we pursue the conceptions, pursue them down below this threshold of consciousness. It is really a process of inner experiential trying that is under consideration here. But it is a matter of doing this review really seriously, not doing it in such a way that after a while we slacken in terms of the seriousness of the matter. But then, if we go through this process of looking back for a longer period, or in general, go through the process of bringing up from memory and experience a world of conceptions arising from our experience, so that we imagine the matter in reverse, that is, make more effort than we have to make when we remember in the ordinary sequence, then we now also have the experience that we are no longer in a position to grasp the conception from a certain point onward in the way we have grasped it in ordinary life on the physical plane. On the physical plane, memory lives itself out in such a way, and it is best for memory on the physical plane if it lives itself out in this way, that if we raise the conception that we want to remember, or should remember faithfully, according to the context in life, we raise it simply in the way we have formed it on the physical plane. But if, through trying as we spoke about, we gradually get used to pursuing the conceptions to below the threshold of consciousness, as it were, then we don't discover them down there as they are in life. That is the mistake people always make when they think they will find in the spiritual world a copy of what is in the physical world. You have to anticipate that the conceptions down there will be different. In reality, they look like this under the threshold of consciousness, that they have shed everything that is characteristic of them on the physical plane. Down there, they completely become images, and they become wholly such that we sense life in them. We sense life in them. It is very important to keep these words in particular in mind. We sense life in them. You can only be convinced that you have really followed a conception down there below the threshold of consciousness when you have the feeling the conception begins to live, to stir. When I compared the ascent to imaginative knowledge with sticking your head into an anthill, I explained it from a different point of view. I said everything begins to stir, everything becomes animated. So, suppose, for example, that during the day, I will take a very ordinary experience, you were sitting at a table and had a book in your hand. Now, at some point in the evening, vividly imagine what that was like, the table, the book, you sitting there as if you were outside yourself. And in this context, it is always good to imagine the whole thing pictorially from the outset, not in abstract thoughts, because abstraction, the capacity for abstraction, has no meaning at all for the imaginative world. So you imagine this picture, yourself sitting at a table with a book in your hand. With table and book, I simply want to say, imagine as vividly as you can some slice of daily life. Then if you really let your soul's gaze rest on this image, if you really intensely meditate on it, then from a certain moment on you will feel different from usual. Indeed, let me say as a comparison, as if you were to take a living creature in your hand. When you take a dead object in your hand, you have the feeling the object is still. It does not tingle or prickle in your hand. Even if you have a moving dead object in your hand, you reassure yourself with the feeling that its life is such that it does not emanate from the object, but is mechanically assigned to it. It is a different matter if you happen to have a living object, say a mouse, in your hand. For example, let's say you have reached into a cupboard, thinking you have picked up some object, and discover you have picked up a mouse. And then you feel the prickling and tingling of the mouse in your hand, don't you? There are people who start screeching when they suddenly feel a mouse in their hand. And the screeching is no less if they haven't yet seen what's prickling and tingling in their hand. There is therefore a difference between holding a dead object and holding a living object. You first have to get used to the living object to be able to bear it in a certain way. People are used to touching dogs and cats, aren't they? But they first have to get used to it. But if you put a living creature into someone's hand in the night, in darkness without them knowing about it, they are also shocked. It is this difference that you feel between touching a dead object and a living object that you have to be clear about. When you touch a dead object, you have a different feeling than when you touch a living one. Now, if you have a conception on the physical plane, you have a feeling that you can compare with touching a dead object. But as soon as you really descend down below the threshold of consciousness, that changes, so that you get the feeling the thought has life inside it, begins to stir. It is, if you like, the same as the discovery you make as a comparison for the inner feeling. When you have grasped a mouse, the thought tingles and prickles. It is very important that we pay attention to this feeling if we are to get an idea of imaginative cognition. Because in the moment that the thoughts we bring up from the subconscious begin to tingle and prickle, begin to behave in such a way that we have the feeling down there, below the threshold, everything is actually bubbling and teeming away. We are in the imaginative world. And while upstairs everything is quite calm, and the thoughts can be controlled so nicely, just like machines can be controlled, down below one thought pursues the other. The thoughts tingle and prickle, bubble and teem. Down there they suddenly turn into a very lively world. It is important to acquire this feeling, because in that moment when you begin to feel the life of the world of thoughts, you are inside the imaginative or elemental world. That's where you are. And you can get in so easily if only you follow the very, very simple rules given in Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? If only you don't try to get into it by way of all kinds of, in quotes, practices alluded to in the last few days. You really can get in so easily. Just think that one of the very first things clearly stated in the book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved, is that one should try, for example, to follow the life of a plant, how it gradually grows, how it gradually dies away. Indeed, if you really follow this, you must go through this life of the plant in your thoughts. First, you have the thought of the very small seed, and if you do not make the thought mobile, you will not be able to keep up with the plant in its growth. You have to make the thought mobile. And then again, when you think of the plant defoliating, gradually dying, withering away, then again you have to think of it shrinking, wrinkling up. As soon as you start thinking about the living sphere, you have to make the thought itself mobile. The thought must begin to gain inner mobility through your own power. There are two beautiful poems by Goethe. One is called The Metamorphosis of Plants, the other The Metamorphosis of Animals. You can read these two poems. You can find them beautiful, but you can also do the following. You can try to really think the thought in these poems as Goethe thought it, from the first line to the last, and then you will find, if you do this, the thought can move inwardly from the beginning to the end. And anyone who does not follow the thought of these poems in this way has not understood metamorphosis. But the person who pursues the thought in this way and then lets it sink down into the unconscious, and again, after they have done this often, recalls this particular thought of metamorphosis, for this is no other thinking than the one you should pursue in Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? The person then who does this, who makes this thought sink down, and then endeavors to do this 50, 60, 100 times, and it might take 101 times, they will be able to raise it up at some point. But then this thought, which they have practiced in this way, will be a mobile one. You will experience that it does not rise up like a small machine, but, forgive the example once more, like a small mouse. You will experience how it itself is an inwardly mobile, living element. I said that we can so easily dive down into this elemental world if we only tear ourselves away a little from the tendency of all people toward abstract thoughts. This tendency to have limited, abstract thoughts instead of inwardly mobile thoughts is so terribly great. You see, people are so eager to say with everything what this or that is and what is meant by it, and are so satisfied when they can say that this or that is meant by it, because that gives them a thought which, like a machine, does not stir. And people become so terribly impatient in ordinary life when you try by all possible means to convey to them fluid and not such abstract thoughts in a box. For all the outer life of the physical plane, and all the life of outer science, consists of such dead thoughts in a box, of nested thoughts. How often have I had to experience people asking me about this or that? Why is that then? What is it? They wanted a completed, rounded thought that they could write down in order to be able to read it off again, to repeat it as often as they wanted, whereas the aspiration might be to have an inwardly mobile thought, a thought that lives on, really lives on. But you see, the thing with the mouse also has its very serious side. Because why do some people screech when they discover they have reached into a cupboard and have a mouse in their hand? Because they're scared. And this feeling also really occurs at the moment when you realize, truly realize, the thought is alive. That's when you start to get scared too. And that is precisely what the good preparation for this event consists of, that you get rid of the fear of the living thought. The materialists do not want to come to such living thoughts. I have often emphasized this. Why? Because they are afraid. Indeed, the master of materialism, Ahriman, appears on one occasion in the mystery drama with the expression fear. There you have the passage in the mysteries, where it is indicated how a person feels when thoughts begin to become mobile. But all the information entitled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved, if followed, will lead a person to get rid of this fear of the mobile, of the living thought, to really get rid of it. So you see, we enter a quite different world, a world at the threshold of which we must truly discard the abstract thinking that dominates the whole physical plane. The endeavor of people who want to enter the occult world with a certain convenience is always that they want to take the ordinary thinking of the physical plane into it. You cannot do that. You cannot take ordinary physical thinking into the occult world. You have to take the mobile thinking into it. All of the thinking must become agile, mobile. If you don't feel this within yourselves, and as I said, you are only not doing it properly if you don't feel it relatively soon, if you don't take into account what I have just said, then it is very easy to fail to grasp the particular nature of the spiritual world. And you must grasp it if you want to concern yourself with the spiritual world at all. You see, it is so difficult to struggle with human abstraction in this field, for when you have grasped this mobility of thought, then you will also understand that a mobile thought cannot appear here or there in any arbitrary way. You cannot, for example, find a land animal in the water. You cannot get the bird that is suited for the air into the habit of living deep down in the water. You cannot but accommodate yourself to the idea, when you deal with the living, that you must not take it out of its element. This is what you have to bear in mind. I once tried in a very strict way, at first in a small area. I always tried to do it this way, but I only want to give it as an example now. To show vividly with a very important thought, in one example in particular, how things must be if you reckon with this inner life of the thought. I gave a small lecture cycle in Copenhagen, entitled The Spiritual Guidance of the Individual and Humanity, close quote, which is also available in print. At a certain point in this lecture cycle, I drew attention to the mystery of the two Jesus boys. Now, let us take the matter as it is presented there. We have a lecture cycle that starts in a certain way. Attention is drawn to how a person can already acquire certain insights when they try to look at the first years of the child's development, try to look back at these things. The whole thing is structured. Then it continues. The contribution of the hierarchies to the progress of humanity is presented. The book is printed. It is probably in everyone's hands, so I am talking about something quite well known. And then, in a certain context, at a very specific point, the two Jesus boys are mentioned. This is part of discussing the two Jesus boys, that it happens in a certain place. And if someone says, well, why shouldn't we be able to extract this discussion of the two Jesus boys and present it exoterically, torn out in this way? That person is asking the same question as someone who asks, why does the hand have to sit right here on the arm, on this part of the body? They might even say, why isn't the hand on the knee? That's where it might also be. They don't understand the whole organism of a living being. They think the hand could be somewhere else, don't they? The hand cannot sit anywhere other than on the arm. So in this context, the idea of the two Jesus boys cannot be in any other place, because the endeavor is to structure the matter in such a way that the living thought lies within the account. Now, someone comes along and writes a piece and crudely extracts this idea and relates it to other ideas which are totally unconnected. But that means nothing other than they attach the hand to the knee. What does a person do who attaches the hand to the knee? Well, you wouldn't be able to do it on an organism, but you could draw it. You can do anything on paper. You could simply draw a human figure, truncated here, and the two knees, so that hands grow out of them. In brackets, this drawing has not been preserved. So you see, someone could draw that, but then they would have drawn an impossible organism. They would have proved that they don't understand anything about real life. You could also use the comparison. They have submerged the eagle, a bird that is meant for the air, into the depths of the sea or the like. What then has such a person tried to do? Well, look, what they have attempted can be done quite easily with all things that relate only to cognitions of the physical plane. One professor can write a book starting with something, another can start with something else, and it doesn't really matter. You can remove things from it and so on. But here you are not dealing with living beings, but with thought machines. That is the crux of the matter. So, a person who does something like that by removing such a matter from its context and putting it into an impossible context has proved that they are completely unfamiliar with the nature of what has filled with fire and set ablaze our whole spiritual scientific stream since its inception, because they also try to treat the spiritual in accordance with the quite normal materialistic formula. That is very important. It is very important to keep these things in mind. Otherwise, you will not understand from within the thrust of higher cognition. You cannot say everything in any old place. And Hegel has really already said it with regard to the exoteric, which touches a little on the esoteric, that a thought belongs in its place in context. I hinted at this the other day when I tried to indicate something in this direction on Hegel's birthday. So you arrive at nothing less in this way than that you immerse your thinking in life, whereas otherwise you always live in what is dead. You immerse yourself in life. In this way, however, something is revealed which was previously not at all recognizable, and which cannot be verified in any way on the physical plane, namely coming into being and passing away. This, too, you can already see from title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How is it Achieved? After all, nothing can be observed on the physical plane other than that which has come into being. The process of coming into being cannot be observed in any way. Only what has come into being can be observed on the physical plane. Nor can passing away be observed. For when the object passes over into passing away, it is no longer on the physical plane. Or at least it moves away from the physical plane. So you cannot observe coming into being and passing away on the physical plane. The consequence of this is that we can say, we enter a whole new cosmic element when we discover the mobile thought, namely the world of life, and that is the world of coming into being and passing away. Speaking in occult terms, this could also be expressed in the following way. The human being was in the world of coming into being and passing away during the old moon period, but only in dream consciousness. There, it was not the case that the human being first saw what had come into being with their senses, for their senses had not yet developed for sensory perception. But they were still inside things. They pictured things in a dreamlike way. But the images they pictured in a dreamlike way allowed them to follow coming into being and passing away. And that is what they must first rise to again by attaining mobile thoughts. Thus the ascent to imaginative cognition is at the same time a return, only a return on the level of consciousness. We return to something we grew out of. We return properly. So that we can say, this imaginative cognition is the return to the world of coming into being and passing away. So we discover coming into being and passing away when we return. And we cannot learn anything at all about coming into being and passing away if we do not come to imaginative cognition. It is quite impossible to identify anything about coming into being and passing away without coming to imaginative cognition. That is why what Goethe wrote about the metamorphosis of plants and animals is so infinitely significant, because Goethe really wrote it from the standpoint of imaginative cognition. And that is why people could not understand what was actually meant when I wrote my commentaries for Goethe's scientific writings, which set out again and again, in all different ways, that it was not at all important to measure Goethe's findings against the present scientific findings, but to immerse oneself in these scientific findings of Goethe's and to see in them something tremendously superior, to see something quite different from the present scientific findings. That is why I referred to words that Goethe said so beautifully and in which he hints at what is important to him. Goethe went on his Italian journey and followed with interest not only art, but also nature. If you read the title Italian Journey, you can see how step by step he immersed himself in everything that the mineral, vegetable sphere, and so on could offer him. And then, when he had arrived in Sicily, he said, after what he had observed there, now he would like to make a journey to India, not to discover something new, but to look at what had been discovered, what had already been discovered by others, in his own way. In other words, to look at it with mobile concepts. That is what matters. To look at what others have discovered with mobile concepts. That is what is so tremendously significant, that Goethe introduced these mobile concepts into scientific life. Therefore, for the person with an occult understanding, the following is a fact which is generally misunderstood. Ernest Haeckel and other materialistic, or, as people also say, monistic scholars have spoken very appreciatively about Goethe's metamorphosis of plants and animals. But the fact that they were able to express their appreciation is based on a very strange process, which I also want to make clear to you by a comparison. Suppose you have a plant in front of you in a flower pot, or even better still, outside in the garden, and you want to enjoy that plant. You go out into the garden to enjoy it, to put yourself into a relationship with it. And now imagine that there is a person who has no use for it. And when you ask yourself why, then you discover it is actually life that bothers them. And so they make a very fine replica of the plant, so that the plant is now like the real one, but in papier-mâché. They put that in their room, and now they enjoy it. Life bothered them, only now do they enjoy it. I can't tell you what agonies I endured as a boy with such a comparison, which is also characteristic of people's attitudes. As a boy, I often had to listen to someone who wanted to emphasize the beauty of a rose, saying, "Truly, it is like wax." That drives me mad. But it happens. It really happens that someone emphasizes the excellence of a living thing by saying in their turn a phrase that it is like a dead thing. That really happens. For anyone who has a sense of these things, it is something terrible. But if you don't have such a sense, you really can't develop in accordance with reality. Now then, with Ernst Haeckel, the following happened. Goethe wrote The Metamorphosis of Plants and The Metamorphosis of Animals. Haeckel reads them, and Ahriman transforms the living things Goethe has written into replicas for him, into something that is actually made of papier-mâché, and that he can understand. He rather likes that. So that in what he praises, we don't have praised what Goethe really meant, but Haeckel has first transposed it into something mechanistic. The thing is that Ahriman, who transforms the living into the dead, steps between Goethe and Haeckel. Now, as I said, this conscious ascent to imaginative cognition is a return. I already said at the beginning of the lecture, actually the imaginations are already in us. They have been in us since the moon period, and earth development consists of us having superimposed the ordinary layers of consciousness. Now we return again, through what we have acquired in ordinary earth consciousness. It is a real return. And now we can ask ourselves, how can we describe the whole thing? We can now say, it is a descent and an ascending return. Only now are we justified in drawing this line, brackets. The words on the blackboard are connected by a line, see diagram, close bracket. Adding it from the outset would make no sense. And only now can we say, at the level of ordinary physical cognition, there we are at the bottom. Here we have the unconscious imaginative cognition that now sits down below in our nature, which has to do with the forces of coming into being and passing away. And on the other side, in the ascent, is conscious imaginative cognition. Both were marked on the blackboard. If we now take Goethe in particular as an obvious example, I will only take him as an example, we can say in Goethe's case, the point has come in the more modern age at which the outer development of humanity grasps imaginative cognition, at which it is really being introduced into science. Now we can ask ourselves, so can we examine whether there are not quite remarkable things connected with it? Yes, they are connected with it, because basically the whole Goethean way of thinking is quite different from that of other people. And Schiller, who could not develop this way of thinking, could, therefore, only understand Goethe with an extreme effort. As you can see in the passage of the correspondence between Schiller and Goethe I have often mentioned, where Schiller writes to Goethe on 23 August 1794, long quote, "For a long time now, although from quite a distance, I have watched the course taken by your spirit, and noted with ever-renewed admiration the path you have marked out for yourself. You seek what nature is by necessity, but you seek it by the most difficult path, which everyone less forceful will take care to avoid. You take the whole of nature together in order to throw a light on the individual part. In the totality of its manifestations, you seek the ground on which to explain the individual. From the simple organization you ascend step by step to the more intricate, to finally build the most intricate of all, the human being, genetically from the materials of the whole edifice of nature. By recreating them from nature, as it were, you seek to penetrate their hidden engineering, a great and truly heroic idea, which shows abundantly how much your spirit holds the rich totality of its ideas together in beautiful unity. You can never have hoped that your life would suffice for such a goal, but even to set out on such a path is worth more than to complete any other. And you have chosen, like Achilles in the Iliad, between Phthia and immortality. Had you been born a Greek, even only an Italian, and if exquisite nature and idealizing art had surrounded you from the cradle, your path would have been infinitely shortened, perhaps made entirely superfluous. Already in your first perception of things, you would then have taken in the form of necessity, and with your first experiences, the great style would have developed in you. Well, since you were born a German, since your Greek spirit was thrown into this Nordic creation, You had no choice but either to become a Nordic artist yourself, or to replace, for your imagination, what reality withheld from it, by tutoring it with the help of your thinking, and thus to give birth to a Greece from within, as it were, and in a rational way. In that period of life when the soul forms its inner world out of the outer, surrounded by deficient forms, you had already absorbed a wild and Nordic nature, when your victorious genius, superior to its material, discovered this deficiency from within, and was assured of it from without by acquaintance with Greek nature. Now you had to correct the old inferior nature that had already been imposed on your imagination, in accordance with the better design that your formative spirit created for itself. And this, of course, cannot proceed in any other way than according to guiding concepts. But this logical direction, which the spirit is compelled to take in reflection, is not well compatible with the aesthetic one, through which alone it creates. So you had one more job, because just as you passed from perception to abstraction, so now you had to convert concepts backward into intuitions again, and transform thoughts into feelings, because only through these can genius be productive. Close quote. Steiner again. He thinks of him as a Greek transplanted into the Nordic world, and so on. There indeed you can see the whole difficulty Schiller had in understanding Goethe. Many a person could learn something from this, who believes they can understand Goethe in the blink of an eye and thereby elevate themselves above Schiller, even though Schiller wasn't exactly a fool compared to those people who believe they can understand Goethe so easily. But the distinctive thing we can discover is that Goethe also has a quite distinctively divergent view in relation to other areas, for example, in relation to the ethical development of the human being, namely, in the way of thinking about what the human being deserves or does not deserve as reward or punishment. We fail to understand Goethe's work from the outset if we don't consider his way of thinking about the human being in terms of reward and punishment, which, I would like to say, diverged from all those around him. Read the poem Prometheus, where he goes as far as to rebel against the gods. Prometheus, this is, of course, a rebellion against the way people think about reward and punishment. For Goethe, the possibility exists of developing very specific concepts about reward and punishment. And in his title Wilhelm Meister, he really tried to portray this in what I might call a wonderfully probing way into the mysteries of the world. You cannot understand Wilhelm Meister if you don't consider this. What is the reason for that? The reason for that is that in the field of physical cognition, we cannot form any idea at all as to what punishment or reward should be applied with regard to anything human in relation to the world. For this can only come to be understood in the field of the imagination. The occultists have therefore also always said, when you ascend to imaginative knowledge, you experience not only the elemental world, but also, as they put it, quote, the world of wrath and punishment, close quote. So, here it is not only a return to the world of coming into being and passing away, but at the same time an ascent to the world of wrath and punishment. Bracket, the words, quote, return to the world of coming into being and passing away, close quote, and, quote, world of wrath and punishment, close quote, were written on the blackboard, close bracket. That is why the particular possibility of linking what the human being is worth and not worth in relation to the universe can only be properly illuminated by spiritual science. All other execution, in quotes, in the world is preparatory for this. Here we are at an important point, from which I will then continue tomorrow. The end of Lecture 2.